And in fact, you don't even need to say it. You can have it printed on paper and enclosed in a silver box on the end of the stick. And all you have to do is rotate the thing. So the popular idea of this is the shortcut. The next idea of it is the one I've been sort of talking about, which is that you concentrate on these formulae, on these sounds. And there's a third interpretation, which is you might call the esoteric interpretation, which was originally, as far as I know, the first person to really bring this up was Vasubandhu, whom I told you about last week, who lived, shortly before 400. And he said the whole point, and are now paying the price for it. But most people would agree with the lines of the poet who said, I, a stranger and afraid, in a world I never made. Because we have the strong sensation that our own being inside our skin is extremely different from the world outside our skin. That while there may be intelligence inside human skins, and while there may be values and loving feelings, outside the skin is a world of mechanical process which does not give a damn about any individual, and which is basically unintelligent, being gyrations of blind force. You found that out. Well, then the other side of the picture is, of course, that if you do find that out, you discover that the project of controlling yourself was unnecessary because you were yourself a Buddha from the very beginning. That's what the Upanishads mean when they say, quite simply, tattvamasi. You're it. You, as you are. Now, how can you conceive that? Supposing you let your imagination go and really think through what you would like to happen. Imagine the most gorgeous state of bliss that you can conceive, where there are no worries, no anxiety.
Orthodox, very correct theologians, and shown that they never believed in a God like that with whiskers. And he could have come forward and said, you see, this is a perfectly orthodox book, and I'm not a revolutionary, I'm just going back to the real old-time religion. He didn't do that. And do you know why? He told me. He never read those writers in theological school. He was entirely confined to biblical studies. I never got as far as that, you see? But it's just the same with ever so many people. One of the reasons why so many people turn to an Oriental religion was that the level, the intellectual level at which Oriental religions were first presented in the West was so much higher than the intellectual level at which Christianity was presented at the local church. If you lived in India, or
whole universe, which is your own body, and instead of regarding yourselves as poor, frustrated, angry little outcasts infesting a ball of rock that revolves round an unimportant star on the outer fringes of a minor galaxy. And it's a big put down. As if to say, that's the way things are, baby, and I'm a real tough guy because I recognize that. You may believe in God and someone up there who cares, but that's for little old ladies and children. But actually, any place in space can be considered as the middle of all space. because it's curved, like the surface of a sphere. Any point on it is the middle of it. Everybody's in the middle. The tiniest little amoeba thinks it's human.
Most of us are short of breath. We never really empty our lungs. But to make a long, complete out-breath, you mustn't force it. Imagine there's a large ball of lead inside your neck. And allow it to fall slowly through your body to the floor, pushing and easing the breath out as it drops. Ease the breath out.
And I feel rather shaky about doing that for myself, but I just hope there's a God who'll take care of it. Or, if I could be loving, I would have a better opinion of myself. I'd feel better about it. I could face myself, as people say, if I were more loving. So the unloving me, somehow, by some gimmickry, has to turn itself into a loving me, and this is just like trying to lift yourself off the ground with your own bootstraps. It can't be done. And that's why religion, in practice, mainly produces hypocrisy and guilt, because of the constant failure of these enterprises. Oh, people go and study Zen, and they come back and say, wow, getting rid of your ego is a superhuman task. I assure you it's going to be very, very difficult to get rid of your ego. You're going to have to sit for a long time, and you're going to get the sorest legs.
Change. But we're always running on the same track, and there's no beginning or end to the track. Beginningless and endless track. There's no starting point, nor goal, nothing to attain. Just to run on the track is our way. This is the nature of our Zen practice. But when you become curious about the railway track, danger is there. You should not see the railway track. If you look at the track, you'll become dizzy. Just appreciate the sights you see from the train. That's our way. There is no need for the passengers to be curious about the track. Someone will take care of it. Buddha will take care of it. But sometimes we try to explain the railway track because we become curious if something is always the same. We wonder, how is it possible for the bodhisattva...
As the process goes on, discovers in the course of the discussion what are the fundamental premises to which every one of his students is clinging. What is the foundation of sanity? What do you base your life on? And when he has found out what that is for each student, he destroys it. He shows you that you...
...around, the organism doesn't push the environment around. They are two aspects or poles of the same process.
You see, in the history of philosophy and poetry and art, we always find the interchange of two personality types, which I call prickles and goo. The prickly people are advocates of intellectual porcupinism. They want a rigor. They want precise statistics. And they have a certain clipped attitude in their voices. And you know this very well in academic circles, where there are people who are always edgy like that. And they accuse other people of being disgustingly vague and miasmic and mystical. But the vague, miasmic, and mystical people accuse the prickly people of being mere skeletons with no flesh on their bones. And they say to you, you just rattle. You're not really.
The problem with the nuclear weapons is not how to avoid their use in war, but how to get them off the planet. Then we will go on to consider the various chemicals that have been prepared for biological and chemical warfare. And again, the problem is how to get rid of them, not how to avoid using them. Now, any one of these problems that I've mentioned, taken alone, would be a serious threat to human survival. But taken all together, where are we? We're insane. And this problem...
restricted to things that I think are particularly important. If I notice some particularly beautiful girl in the audience, then I might notice also what she's wearing. And that would be memorable. But by and large, you see, we scan things over, but we pay attention only to what our set of values tells us we ought to pay attention to. But quite obviously, you as a complete individual are much more than the scanning system. You are in relationships, literary historicity and correctness. It would be very wrong of me to forge a document and pretend that it was written by some very venerable person, say by Dr. Suzuki or by Goethe. But centuries ago...
And I must say that, you see, I can't understand that very well. I don't understand when people expect that a so-called enlightened person should not need this, that, and the other. It might be beautiful surroundings, it might be the love of the opposite sex, it might be, I don't know what. You shouldn't need that. In other words, you should scrub everything down to basic. And the end of that is, you know, let's scrub the planet, let's get all this disease called life off it and have a nice clean rock. I believe in color. I believe in, if you're going to do anything in the way of the illusory dance, let's live it up. Let's really do it. And let's not be take ourselves so damn seriously that we have to be scrubbed all the time of any kind of ornamentation or frivolity. Oh, hooray.
That is to say, if you're not going to be a professional, if you're not going to be a teacher yourself, if you're not going to be a priest, you're just a lay student of Zen. And if you stay, if you go year after year after year back to this guy, he starts to get troubled and says, you are addicted to medicine. It's becoming a bad habit. And somehow you have to get rid of Zen. So... or all those pebbles. But we've done that. And so to us that is perfectly simple. But imagine the kind of mentality, the kind of person to whom that is not simple at all. Well, now, in exactly the same way, there is here what I'm trying to explain, a new idea that most people don't assimilate. And that is the idea of the total interdependence of everything in the world. The Buddhists in Japan call it jijimuge. Jijimuge, between thing and thing, between event and event, there is no block. And they represent this imagistically as a network. Imagine a multidimensional spider web covered in dew in the morning. And everything ties together, all the past and the future, you feel it dragging at you every way. Supposing you wake up in the morning, and it's a lovely morning. Let's take today, right here and now, here we are in this paradise of a place. Big Sur. And some of us have got to go to work on Monday. Is that a problem? For many people it is. It spoils the taste of what's going on now. When we wake up in bed on Monday morning and think of the various hurdles we've got to jump that day, immediately we feel sad and bored and bothered. Whereas actually we're just lying in bed. So the Taoist trick says, simply live now and there will be no problems. That's the meaning of the Zen saying. Then realize also, going beyond that, that you are in the external world you're looking at. You see, I'm in your external world, you're in my external world. But I'm in the same world you are. My inside is not separable from the outside world. It's something the so-called outside world is doing. Just as it's doing the tree and the ocean and everything else that is in the outside world. Now, isn't that great, you see? We've completely got rid of the person in the trap. The one who either dominates the world or suffers under it. It's vanished. It never was there. And when that happens, you see, you can play any life game you want to.
They are the guardians of the 10 directions of the universe. Buddhism and Hinduism have 10 directions, that is to say, 8 points of the compass, plus above and below. And these very fierce creatures stand at all temple entrances. And they are essentially the cosmic traffic cops. Because they have to be fierce. Because somebody has to lay down the law that we do recognize north, south, east, and west in a very firm way. And up has to be clearly distinguished from down, you see? So these people have a very important function. But at the same time, the Dharma Rajas have a slight twinkle in the eye for all their fierceness. They know, you see, that the 10 directions are conventional. They don't think that they are absolutely real. They are enlightened, all of them. They're all bodhisattvas in the aspect of a bodhisattva which is wrathful. I suppose I haven't looked closely enough, but if you look around these paintings, you will find here, for example, is a wrathful bodhisattva, the sort of person who would be a guardian of the directions. In up here, there's this bodhisattva, and this one, they're beneficent. They appear in white color, and they have serene faces. But this one appears in black color and has a wrathful face. This is not a devil, you know, or demon in the Western sense of the word at all. He's simply a manifestation of the fierce side of reality. Some people don't feel really alive unless they're sitting on a spike. That tells them they're there. I went to Mexico this summer to explore this, because in Mexico they enjoy bullfighting and they enjoy a kind of Catholicism in which suffering is the big bit. We went to the Shrine of Guadalupe and watched young girls.
But ordinarily, you've been reading my books. So, but ordinarily people see the ball, the circle, the ring or whatever, and never think of the background. Because they ignore the background. Just as one thinks that you can have pleasure without pain. You want pleasure, the figure, and don't realize that pain is the background. So, avidya is this state of restricted consciousness, restricted attention, that moves through life unaware of the fact that to be implies not to be, and vice versa. So now the third noble truth is called nirvana. One is called by the Japanese Rinzai Zen, after the great master Rinzai, who lived towards the end of the 9th century. And the Soto school comes from another line, and they have a slightly different emphasis. Soto is more serene in its approach, Rinzai more gutsy. Rinzai people use the koan method in Zen study. Soto people don't, at least not in the same way. But this period between the death of the sixth patriarch, Eno, and so Buddha chopped off the finger and undermined all metaphysical beliefs. There are many, many dialogues in the Pali scriptures where people try to corner the Buddha into a metaphysical position. Is the world eternal? The Buddha says nothing. Is the world not eternal? And he answers nothing. Is the world both eternal and not eternal? And he don't say nothing. Is the world neither eternal nor not eternal? And still he don't say nothing. He maintains what is called the noble silence, sometimes later called the thunderous silence. Because this silence, this metaphysical silence, is not a void. It is very powerful. The silence is the open...
He seemed perfectly relaxed in not having any particular point of view. Well, they said, "Teacher, how can you stand it? We have to have something to hang on to." "Who does? Who are you?" And eventually you discover, of course, that it's not necessary to hang on to anything, to rely on anything. There's nothing to rely on, because you're it. It's like the universe. It's like asking the question, where is the universe? And by that I mean the whole universe. Whereabouts is it in space? Everything in it is falling around everything else, but there's no concrete floor underneath for the thing to crash. Because the space from which we get metric, meter, comes from the Sanskrit root, M-A-T-R, which also means to measure, and derived from that is the Sanskrit word maya, which means illusion.